And hello, everyone. Welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Jesse Malott.
Vince Masson.
And, a couple of weeks ago, we go from having no co-host, and now we have two. It's one of those weird weeks. Hi, guys.
Yeah, on that note.
Whatever. Let's start the show.
I thought we were just taking people off the street and making them hosts. So.
Well, we'll see what happens in the months to come.
Yeah.
When everyone gets busy again. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans, and you can find us here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the horror action sci-fi Upgrade. That is in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to not do the usual news items this week, because this coming weekend is Hillside Weekend, which means lots of music and festivities. It's pretty much like a town holiday. Most everybody heads up to the lake for music and fun and frivolity. And so we thought it'd make a fun tie-in. And not to step on the toes of the Silver Screen Dream Machine folks, because they do a show every Friday at 2 p.m. that is all about movie songs and movie soundtracks and things, and we don't want to step on their toes, but I guess we kind of are, because
we're speak for yourself. I want to start a mutiny right now, man.
Want to take Silver Screen Dream Machine down a peg?
Yeah. Okay. Why not?
Cool. All right, let's do that then. So we're going to each talk about our top five songs from movies and why we like them. So, Vince, this is your vendetta, mm-hmm. So why don't you start with your first pick?
All right. I'm, of course, going from a very subjective standpoint. I am in no way saying these are the best movie songs, but I don't know if that needs to be said at this point. So I'm going to go with a song called Glory by Common and John Legend, which mm-hmm. was featured in the wonderful movie Selma, directed by the great Ava DuVernay. Mm-hmm. And the performance was actually so good at the Oscars that it made Chris Pine cry. So you know if you can do that, that you've got some power.
It's probably why you got cast in A Wrinkle in Time.
Yeah, well, I didn't think about that, but that's probably true, yes.
So, yeah, that's a good song and a good movie. Of course, I think it's not to take anything away from the song, but I mean, that's one of those cases where it's like, we are going to win best song.
Yeah.
Here it is.
Yeah. And you know what? Fine. They shamelessly won it. Who's a great, powerful song.
Fair enough. Yeah. I mean, well, there'll probably be more than a couple of those in this list here. Jesse, your first pick.
My first pick is actually a song that probably most people won't necessarily know unless they're huge fans of this band. And this band is like absolutely legendary. And it featured Eric Clapton, Jimmy Page, and Jeff Beck. The band is the Yardbirds, and they're actually featured in Blow Up. And the song they're playing is a song called Stroll On. And the song is actually written specifically for that movie. And Michelangelo Antonioni was a huge fan of this of the band. And he actually wanted them to play the song Train Kept On Rolling. However, Train Kept On Rolling was not their song. It was a cover. So Stroll On, which is virtually identical, at least in terms of the rhythm of that song, and that's what they wrote instead. And they actually featured in the movie. And it's kind of a pivotal scene, and it's towards the end of the movie, and they're actually playing the song like in front of a crowd. And this is like at the height of like mod culture and rock and roll in England in the mid-60s.
This is the scene when he's going into the nightclub and there's a band playing.
Yes, the Yardbirds are playing.
Oh, okay.
Jimmy Page is in that movie.
Okay, awesome.
There you go.
I feel like we're going to get less Oscar winners out of Jesse. just a hunch.
No, you're actually wrong. Two of them on my list are actually, in fact, Oscar winners for best
spoiler
song.
Spoiler alert.
Vince. Don't bring your prejudice in here.
Just started with the Yardbirds doesn't mean it's going obscure. Yeah,
he's not exactly Alan Cross over here.
I've listened to the history of new music for a long time.
All right, he is Alan Cross.
Yeah.
He's listened so long, he's become him.
Take that, Silver Screen. Got your own Alan Cross there?
No, I don't have my own Alex Ross. This is kind of a sentimental pick for me, but I have Susie and the Banshees, Face to Face from Batman Returns, because it's like the one song on that soundtrack, and it's just, it's part of like the whole Tim Burtonification of Batman, that in the transition from Batman to Batman Returns, where it's like he has straight up creative control over everything, and it's this like funky little gothic thing that's all about duality, and it's played entering the pivotal scene where Bruce Wayne and Selina Kyle figure out they're Batman and Catwoman, and it's this extravagant costume ball in a department store with all the cat motifs around, and Christopher Walken walking around in a glittered bedazzled turban. It's really it's completely over the top, but it's one of those. When that movie came out, I was 12 or 13, and my music experience was like top 40 radio. So it's like you never heard Susie and the Banshees on top 40 radio. So that was kind of like a gateway drug to other musical realms for me. But the music works in the scene, because the music too is also at least the music portion of the song was either written by or borrowed from Danny Elfman's score. It just slides in very nicely into the soundtrack of the movie. And then when the revelation is made, it kind of fades out nicely into the Danny Elfman score. And it's one of those things that it's a perfect fit for the movie. And it's much more of a perfect fit than all the Prince songs were in the first Batman. it was like, hey, Tim Burton here, make a Batman movie, make it good, and we're going to wedge this Prince concept album into it as well. So, Vince, you're number two.
So my number two is for no other reason than for sentimental reasons.
Yeah, yeah.
The Be My Guest song from the animated Beauty and the Beast.
Nice, nice.
Which you chuckle, but is actually listed in the AFI Top 100 Best.
That would not surprise me.
Oh, now he stops chuckling. Okay.
No, I mean, I just laughed because I didn't expect that song from you. That's why I laughed. I didn't laugh at the song itself.
Yeah.
He's laughing at you, not the song.
Get it right. So again, it's kind of a weird choice, but I just have this nostalgic kind of feel for that movie, and particularly that scene, which I think is the most visually like interesting scene in that film, actually.
For sure.
And, one of the reasons why, maybe to digress a bit, that the live-action one couldn't quite live up to that one.
Yeah, I mean,
they just couldn't pull off,
Yeah, there's like still some stuff you can only do in animation and make it look good and sell it. And dancing dishware is probably where that line is.
Yeah, stole the words right out of my mouth. Yes.
You're number two, Jesse.
My number two, and to bring up the fact that, no Oscar winners. Well, the simple fact is my number two is actually an Oscar-winning song, and it's very bizarre in the fact that the person that wrote it is the actor singing it in the movie, and he's not a songwriter. And the song is "I'm Easy," and it's from Nashville, and the person that sang it and wrote it is Keith Carradine, and the song is featured in like such a pivotal, bizarre scene. He's simply singing like over and over again, "I'm Easy" is the chorus, and there's three women, two of whom he has slept with and a third that he wants to sleep with, and I believe and all three of these women think that the song is about them. In actual fact, like, he's the only one that's aware of like who he's actually trying to intend the song for, and it was phenomenal, and it's just like so laid back and easygoing, and it has like that kind of rough edge because Keith Carradine wasn't a singer by training.
I like that. I like that when you get actors, out of their lane, and sometimes it leads to disaster. Can't think of one off the top of my head, but there are probably more than a few. But I mean, there's also examples of it being like fairly effective. Suddenly, I think Johnny Depp's a good example of that when he did Sweeney Todd. He had never done a musical. He'd never done singing.
Crybaby.
Oh yeah, that's true.
But his voice was dubbed in that.
That's true too. But I mean, that was Sweeney Todd was straight up authentic Johnny Depp, and now he has a band and everything.
Well, he always wanted to be a musician. Like he fell into acting, I think, because of Nicolas Cage.
Mm-hmm. there's two people you'd like to be in a car with. Anyway.
Yeah, or a band.
Or a band. I don't know if Nicolas Cage. Does Nicolas Cage play?
I don't think so.
That's a shame.
Not that I know of.
That's a shame. I went super cheesy.
Oh, he's married to Lisa Marie, though.
Well, I guess that's something. My number two is super cheesy. It is Celine Dion, My Heart Will Go On. And it's totally, cry-worthy ballad stuff. But it's...
He gets less chuckles for that than I did for dancing silverware, apparently.
It's another one of these where it was the composer... The story behind it, like, nobody wanted to do it. Mm. And it's such a key part of, like, the Titanic lore. It's such a major part of what made that movie successful, I think. Mm-hmm. And nobody wanted to do it. Celine Dion didn't want to sing another movie ballad. James Cameron didn't want to put a cheesy ballad at the end of his movie because he thought it was over the top. You have, like, the two people who are kind of responsible for it, like, not wanting any part of it until they had to have their arms twisted, kind of, to make it happen. And one of the reasons was they wanted to make Titanic commercial, because a lot of people forget. Everyone thought that movie was going to tank. It mm-hmm. was going to bomb, and it was going to drag two studios down with it. And somebody was thinking, well, at least we'll have a hit song out of it. So I think one of the reasons for nostalgia for this is because, it comes from a time when if you wanted to relive, like, the movie memories, you had to have the soundtrack. Mm-hmm. There were no clips on YouTube. You couldn't find the this was 1997, so you could probably go to Apple.com and download the trailer, for 10 hours. But it's, it was before you could have that easy access. Mm-hmm. And I was working at Zellers when it came out on VHS, not DVD, VHS. And it was like a 10-month window. We have Rampage out on DVD mm-hmm. right now, and movies that came out in March and April out on DVD right
That's
now.
True, yeah.
So I think people forget that people relived the movie through the song, and that's why I think it resonates so powerfully.
Hmm. Yeah.
Anyway, you're number three, Vince, and we'll try not to laugh this time.
Okay. It's great. Now how do I, segue into this? Okay, well, my number three is from The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
So You Can't Laugh by default.
No.
And it is the iconic song Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Mm-hmm.
Again, just for nostalgic purposes, just reliving those early memories of... Because I think songs really kind of got stuck into your head when you were a kid mm-hmm. watching these movies, and that's kind of how you lived with them as well. And that song in particular has always, for whatever reason, kind of symbolized a movie song, just something that really is kind of emblematic of, that kind of troubled character seeking to escape their situation and yearning for an adventure, I guess.
Little
and
did Judy Garland know there was more trouble ahead.
And that song always pops up, randomly. You'll see it in, other movies or other TV shows. I think one of the best uses outside of The Wizard of Oz was actually in Scrubs. The one guy, Ted the lawyer, and his band were singing. It was, fantastic because they were doing pure a cappella.
Yeah, it's a song of pure dreaming, and the themes are very easy to grasp onto. It's somebody who's looking at the flat Earth around them, and mm-hmm. wondering what is beyond, and how can I get out of here, and is this my life? And I think we can identify with all of that.
Mm-hmm. And not only that, I take singing lessons, and I have for a few years, and my singing teacher has told me.
Oh, please give us a sample.
No, not on the radio, at least not without preparation. No, but she said one of the standards that she teaches is Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Okay, you're number three.
My number three, actually, since Adam, you've brought up movie soundtracks and how pivotal they are, I was actually going, because I am a big fan of Cameron Crowe, at least his early movies. And like he it's like music is so bred into him. Like he was a rock journalist before he was ever a movie writer. Mm-hmm. And the one movie that always stood out to me, it's not a great movie, but I love it because it brings me back to like when I was in like high school and I was like absolutely obsessed with all the bands from Seattle. And Singles was the movie that featured a lot of them, with the exception of Nirvana. And it's not any of their songs that stand out to me. It's actually the one that was actually frequently played with the trailer, and it was called Waiting for Somebody by Paul Westerberg. And mm-hmm. Paul Westerberg is... He definitely has an iconic status. To anybody that listens to alternative and indie rock should know who the Replacements are. And he actually scored the movie as well. And like that movie, I mean, that song reminds me just of the theme of the movie itself. And because it's always about like these couples that are like falling in and out of love with each other. And that's what the song essentially is saying throughout. Mm-hmm. And that's why it was like used throughout the trailer. And it appears in the movie, I think, twice.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Very cool. Yeah, Cameron Crowe is a good... he's not just like... him and Tarantino, I think, are two guys who aren't just, you know, sort of directors. They're also kind of their own music supervisors.
Yeah, Fincher as well.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, it's Fincher, a bit different because I think Tarantino and Crowe both have that, like, jukebox mentality where it's like, this scene, it goes with this song, and this scene goes with this song. Mm-hmm. And they kind of build around... I mean, Tarantino's kind of... gone in a different direction in the last few films, but I almost put a song from a Cameron Crowe movie on my list, but instead I put I put Footloose by Kenny Loggins from Footloose. I think it's like one of the don't laugh at me, I'm not Vince.
No, I was laughing because I was thinking like Kenny Loggins, I'm like, oh wait a minute, Danger Zone.
No, No, you're right, because I was thinking of Danger Zone, but I don't associate Danger Zone with Top Gun the movie. I associate Danger Zone with Top Gun the ride from Wonderland.
Really?
Because they played Danger, when you go past there or you were lined up there, Danger Zone would be on a frickin' loop, and you would get so sick from hearing it, depending on how long the line is, or if you're in a line in the general vicinity, because like for... you know, 12, 13 hours a day, it's get into the danger zone. Jesse won't sing, but I will. Footloose, though, it's, you know, it's the first song used, and it's, you know, I think it's very emblematic of the themes of the movie. It's like people want to get up and dance, and this song makes you want to get up and dance. And I think that's, you know, there's just a simple pleasure to it. You hear the opening beats and your toe starts tapping and your toes
start getting loose.
And that leads to the whole foot getting loose.
Yeah. I see how they, yeah.
Exactly.
Mr. Loggins, genius.
Yeah. He is a genius. Yeah. Some historians will look back and say he gave birth to the 80s.
Yeah. And then Adam and Vince, you know, like analyzed it in such a wonderful, poetic way.
All right, let's get to number four.
All right, my number four is actually a movie from a couple years back. It is City of Stars from La La Land.
Right.
And I was actually like debating whether or not to put this on because I felt this obligation that my list needed to be iconic songs. And, you know... cinematically important songs, let's say. But the truth is, like, that this whole soundtrack honestly is just something that I have found myself loving more and more as the years kind of pass. And that's kind of strange for me with a musical. But this song in particular, it's kind of a very interesting moment in the movie. That's kind of, you know, very cliched, trope-ish of musicals when the man is kind of realizing that he's attracted to the woman and has some, you know, whatever.
Unfinished business.
Sad, intimate song to go along with it.
Yeah.
So City of Stars is Ryan Gosling's kind of sad, intimate song when he says in the song, you know what I mean? Could this be another? That's what I'm afraid of, that I'm going to get coaxed into doing that. because he's had a lot of failures in the past in the movie, and so he's kind of pontificating about whether or not it can be this relationship with Emma Stone will be a failure as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's weird too because he's one of the '90s like musketeers who he's the only one that didn't grow up to be a famous pop star.
Yeah.
It just made me think of that because like his voice is so unpolished when he's singing
Right.
And it just made me think, oh wait a minute, Christina Aguilera, Britney Spears, and Justin Timberlake.
Yeah, true.
Who are all polished singers?
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe not
just
Christina.
To varying degrees. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
I will not hear a bad word about Christina Aguilera.
No, I think she's fantastic. She has a great voice. Wouldn't say she's a polished singer, though. But.
Yeah, she's not auto-tuned assist.
Which is fantastic.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough. Number four for you, Jesse.
Number four for me is yet another Oscar winner for Best Song.
Oh, wow.
And the movie is Once. And
oh, I love Once.
Yes, absolutely. And me too. And it introduced me to Glenn Hansard, and like I had to realize, I'm like why haven't I heard of this guy before? And he had been recording music for probably about 16, 17 years at that point. He had a previous band, the Frames, mm-hmm. and I've listened to absolutely everything that they've done. Like because of Once, like I went back and like realized like who this guy was and the fact that he was actually a well-known Irish singer, and I've seen him live twice. He's like very, very colorful, and both times I've seen him, he's played "Falling Slowly," which is the song.
Mm-hmm.
And just every time that I see him live, he always has he's a typical Irishman, and like almost every single one of his stories starts off in a bar somewhere.
Yep.
And he even admits that too. He's just like, sorry, I don't want to be an Irish stereotype. But yeah, watching that movie and like listening to that song especially, and all the other songs in the movie too, because like the soundtrack for that movie is phenomenal, and it's just like so emotive, and he has like such a powerful like untrained voice, and he was a busker, and he like literally dropped out of high school just to be a singer,
mm-hmm.
and that's like so inspirational because like very few people could basically drop out of high school and then wind up being a Oscar winner, a Grammy winner, have a Tony Award winning musical based on a movie about your life, and yet like this is what happened to this guy.
Falling Slowly is good, but I like one of the solos by her name's Mariska Iglova. Yeah. I like one of her songs on that soundtrack. That's one of my favorite.
I just haven't seen the movie, so I'll...
Too busy watching Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah, maybe.
All right.
Now that I know it's Oscar winner, like I have to.
I'm going to go back to the 80s again, and I'm going with If You Leave by the Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, OMD. It's from Pretty in Pink. It's interesting that the movie, because the song came out before the movie. The song was written actually because of the movie. Molly Ringwald suggested to John Hughes that he write a movie based around this song, Pretty in Pink. That's not the song the movie's remembered for. It's for this If You Leave, which was actually a last-minute addition to the soundtrack because the ending didn't work, and they were going to do reshoots, and John Hughes was like, no, the song doesn't even work, so we went back to OMD, and he's like, hey, give me a new song, and then they were going out and tour in 48 hours, so they put together a whole new song in 24 hours, and that's the song it's like 4 minutes long in... when you listen to it, but in the movie it's like 16 minutes long, and I tried to look up the factoid about how long it's playing in the actual movie and how much longer it is than the actual song. I couldn't find it, but yeah, when you listen to when you watch the movie Pretty in Pink, that's at the end at the prom, If You Leave, it's like playing for easily like 12-15 minutes. it's in a Gata De Vida, it's almost that length. Anyway, Vince, your number five.
My number five is probably arguably one of the most iconic songs in cinematic history, and it's Singing in the Rain.
Oh yeah,
from the movie Singing in the Rain.
Yeah.
Which was a movie that I had put off for many, many years. For whatever reason, it just didn't. I knew it was something that I was somewhat obligated to see as a cinema lover. I would have to get around to it at some point. I just like put it off. And, you know, I think it's still a part of our popular culture, too. You know, yeah. What I mean? The image of Gene Kelly.
Singing in the rain.
Yeah, it's still something that's kind of iconic to us. So maybe I was turned off a bit by, you know, its popularity. But when I finally got around to it, to watching the movie, and I recommend a lot of people do that because I think it's easy to know or to think you know or are familiar with the movie just because of how frequently it comes up in pop culture. But the movie itself is still wonderful, still as kind of endearing. And now I feel kind of fascinating from a certain standpoint when, you know, the sound is coming into cinema and they have to deal with all of that kind of those kind of shenanigans on set and whatever. Those are kind of like historically interesting, I think, as well. So,
yeah, and wonderfully parodied in Clockwork Orange, too. Jesse, you're number five.
My number five. I guess I'm kind of it was kind of hard to find a, because I guess I was just going by directors for whatever reason. And I guess I came across the fact that, like, I was, like, noticing, like, Wes Anderson has, like, so many fantastic soundtracks, Cameron Crowe as well.
Yeah.
And then David Fincher, I'm like, yeah, unfortunately, I'm going to have to put a song from one of Fincher's movies. Although this song was not an original song. I mean, this song was from the mid to late 80s. And the song appears at the end of the credits on Fight Club. And it is Where Is My Mind by the Pixies.
Oh, yeah.
And it was strange how I came across this song too, because I heard the song on Fight Club, and I just like loved the blazing guitar, and actually bringing it back to Alan Cross, this is how I came across the Pixies, is that I had listened to his he was doing a history of the like 25 greatest bands of alternative rock, and I listened to what he was talking about about the Pixies, and I'd heard that like he referred to the album Surfer Rosa, and I'd heard like the two or three songs they played. Not a single one of them, though, was Where Is My Mind. When I bought Surfer Rosa, I had listened to it, and then when I heard that song, I was like, oh my God, this is them. Like, so like I had no idea like who wrote that song until I had bought that album. Mm-hmm. And I just happened to buy that album and it happened to be on it.
Yeah, and it's kind of gotten, I don't want to say corrupted, but a lot of different places have played that song since Fight Club. It's been used in a lot of different ways.
Well, and also like once again, there's an iconic band who like, mm-hmm. like you can't, I can't possibly name any band from the past 30 years that I listen to that don't listen to the Pixies and don't constantly reference them.
Yeah, absolutely. My last pick isn't quite so esoteric, but it's fun. It's a little ditty called Men in Black by Will Smith from the Men in Black, and it, you know, harkens back to a time where Will Smith would act in a movie and then do the theme song. And even like the last Men in Black movie, Men in Black 3, he didn't do the theme song, which makes me kind of sad because it's such a solid little ditty. It's so much fun. It's, you know, where he's basically rapping about everything that's happening in the movie. It's something we don't really get anymore. It's such a treat to have like an actual straight up theme song, because it feels like only the James Bond movies do that. And you know, if they're parroting James Bond movies like back in Deadpool 2 recently.
That's right. He did Wild Wild West too, which was a good, like, you know.
And he did one for Men in Black 2,
right.
Which wasn't as big as Men in Black, but I think it's still kind of solid.
Well, and also, like, Will Smith was a singer, like, long before he was an actor. Yeah. And it was only because of the videos and the way he characterized himself in videos that people are just like, wait a minute, maybe this guy could be an actor and be on TV.
Yeah, it's a shame that he's kind of lost that part. I mean, maybe he thinks it's, you know, something from, it belongs in his younger days, and maybe he doesn't, you know, maybe he's lost that that verve, that desire to do that stuff. Yeah, and I mean, then that's kind of sad because I would have loved to have seen the Suicide Squad theme song. But or Bright.
Yeah. You and only you wanted to hear those.
Very true. So coming up next, we're going to talk about the new movie Upgrade. And before that, Logan Marshall Green's not the only one getting an upgrade because we have Josh Green, and he has a new song called Upgrade. And so we're going to upgrade to a review after the break. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, well, campus and community radio. I've seen a struggle up late nights, working double, know my kids, my heart. Create a future for them while I'm working hard. No one gonna do it for me, yeah, they keep me strong. Gotta find balance, my spirit and my values. Gotta watch what I channel, cause I'm on a lonely road. No need for company, when I already know you're not the one for me. But somehow you think I need some confidence when I'm just searching for that God in me. My whole life I've been searching to find a state of mind, no defined clear truth. When I look back, I was looking for God. Meanwhile, God was looking for me. This whole time I spent my life, I was praying to the Savior, but we gotta save our.
Let me know if you need my help, friend.
Help!
I need your permission to operate independently.
Permission granted!
Thank you.
Okay, it's done. What are we doing, man?
Just relax.
Oh, look, man, stay down, please. Please don't get up. Please don't.
Bad news, he gets up. and that is a clip from Upgrade. It is the new film by Lee Wano, and it stars Logan Marshall Green, Betty Gabriel, Simon Madden, Benedict Hardy, and Harrison Gilbertson. A lot of those people, I think, are Australian actors, so you may
not
have
heard of them.
Yeah,
I've never heard of. Yeah, I was going to follow that up.
So, yeah, it's...
And Lee Wennell, what was the last time? What was the last thing he did?
Last that's time a good I question. Heard. I think. Well, he didn't he write the Insidious movies?
Yeah, I was taking a look at his filmography.
Okay.
Yeah, so he's been around, but Lee Wennell, for everyone who may not know, is probably most famous for starting the Saw series
and
with
being the guy
James Wan,
who was chained to the bathtub.
Yes,
in
he
the
was
first. Saw a movie.
Right. He was Cary Elwes' cellmate and is never seen again, unlike Cary Elwes.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert for the Saw series.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Go and sit down and subject yourself to 14 hours of that.
been there, done that. One in 3D, so.
Oh, there. Don't remind me. let's talk about Upgrade.
Let's upgrade our talk. Yeah.
Oh, there you go. Good. Well done. Let's upgrade our discussion. I have a feeling since you brought Jesse for backup, Vince, that you thought there was going to be some kind of...
Yeah, we have the power in numbers now. Yeah.
I'm still at the controls. I'm not sure. Anyway.
Yeah, who has the authority?
Yeah, that's okay. Right. But I will admit, I was surprised by how many critics have, how fresh this is on Rotten Tomatoes. I will admit, I am surprised.
I am surprised that you take Rotten Tomatoes as some, like, authority review thing.
Well, I mean, it's a good sort of, like, you put your finger in the lake to see if it's warm or cool. It's not going to give you the exact temperature.
You know what? As Steven Soderbergh once said, I would like to see what 2001 A Space Odyssey would have gotten on Rotten Tomatoes when it came out.
To me, definitely. I would have loved to have seen that, too. But, I mean, you're right. But I'm just saying, I have a feeling that there's more critical appeal for this than I felt.
Okay, sure.
So, how did you feel?
Well, I had a really good time with this movie, actually. You know, you can't really go into this expecting anything.
I'm kidding.
Anything
that
with like artistic integrity. Okay.
Well, it's that's watch. Too far for me. I would say there's artistic integrity. I'm not. But keep going.
Okay. Sure. Yes. I take that back.
There's a commitment to vision. I will say that.
Right. Too much artistic integrity, maybe, is maybe. What I should have said.
Maybe.
But, man, I was thoroughly entertained by this movie, I have to say. Okay. So it's about this guy. His wife is murdered. They have a car accident. His wife is murdered. And he is nearly murdered, if I recall correctly. Mm-hmm. And he wakes up, and he is being literally upgraded. His body is being given these... or this implanted with this system that can kind of take control of his body, and then he goes after and tracks down the killers, and it becomes kind of a revenge movie.
Yeah, his injuries are, he's a quadriplegic where he's...
Correct, yeah.
He's immobile from the neck down, and he's given a chip that allows, that connects his... the way that's described in the movie, the connection that tells his... that his brain tells his limbs to work is broken. That chip is supposed to bridge that gap. But as you've heard in the clip, the chip does considerably more. And it is called STEM, which I thought was kind of cute. But what did you think, Jesse?
I did like the general feel and the atmosphere of the movie. Mm-hmm. And I absolutely love the way the movie kicked off, because I thought it was just like, okay, this is kind of a weird, like retro movie. I didn't realize it was like futuristic at all. And the reason why I was like thought it was a retro movie is because it kicks off with a very retro song. It was Smokestack Lightning by Howlin' Wolf. And like, talk about like classic bluesmen. And this, again, bringing it back to, oddly enough, the Yardbirds, they covered they covered that song as well.
Yeah, the music segment ended, Jesse. We're on to the review portion.
But yeah, no, I thought it was like really atmospheric, and that's definitely what I appreciated about it. And I did kind of think that, like, I knew exactly where this movie was going as soon as the car crashed. I'm like, okay, this is going to be a revenge movie. Like, I knew it like right away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was actually surprised how good the kind of world looked. Actually, like it visually, the visual effects. Like establishing it were kind of interesting. You know
it
what
does
I mean?
The
it's got these
thing.
Self-driving cars, and the cars all kind of look future. I thought it was okay.
Yeah, it does the dread thing where it's clearly shot in the real world and it's been augmented to make it look futuristic with taller buildings and more like drones flying around and things. It's I did appreciate that. It looks very, very good. I will give Lee Wen all that. But I think where I depart is what you said, where it's very easy to see where it's going. And I knew where it was going before that. When they're at Aaron's house, Aaron's the guy who invented the STEM chip, and he's like, oh, here's my chip. It can make you do anything. It's the future. And I was like, okay. One of them's going to get chipped, and that's what the movie's going to be about.
Okay, but why... There's, I guess you're not saying it's a bad movie, just that it's a predictable
It's movie. Terribly predictable.
Right.
It's very...
I also thought so too, but the way that they went about it was kind of clever, okay? Yeah. How he has to kind of activate the system and say, you know, for instance, like he's being beaten up by a guy and then he says, you know, whatever, turn on, and then the machine will literally, or the program chip, whatever, will take control of his body and... you know, perform, you know, under its kind of control. So that kind of leads to, like, you know, him being this martial arts expert or whatever via the chip, you know what I mean? And I thought it was really clever how they did that. The fight scenes are all kind of really exciting. They're all fun, I thought.
Yeah, great use of Steadicam.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the action is solid. And I think the physicality is where Logan Marshall Green is very, very good. Mm-hmm. He looks like he's being controlled by a robot. I mean, as a compliment, there's the way he's like he walks, and the way he's moved, and his physicality is very, very good. I did not buy him though as kind of like any of the emotional stuff or like missing his wife and his his interaction with this machine, because I think he should be more freaked out, because this character is painted very much as like a Luddite. He's very technology adverse. So like he's even freaked out. Like his wife has one of those self-driving cars, and he you can see in that scene where they're driving home in the self-driving car, he does not like it one bit.
Yeah,
and I just feel like there's. I think where I have trouble with it is it should have been more on with some of its themes. Like, how would this guy who is technology adverse feel about now he's had to turn his life over effectively to a microchip in his spine?
I agree. It could have gone down those avenues, but it wasn't trying to be that movie. It was just trying to be a fun B movie where you watch.
But it introduces that, though. It introduces those elements. So it, in part, it wants to be that movie in a way. Because there's also the Cirque character. It's one of the guys that kills his wife. And Cirque, you know, there's this whole, like, population that has, like, machines implanted in them. And that's kind of never really explained, like, why are people walking around with machines inside them other than it's the future? But I found this character interesting for, the couple of months we actually get to know him. Because he's kind of like the cyborg Magneto. Because he's like, you know, we're just better. We got machines inside us. We're better than ordinary humans. We should be working together because now you're part machine and I'm part machine, and yay, cyborgs. And I mean, I love these kind of ideas, but then it has to go back to, you killed my wife, so splat. It's...
Yeah, that's what he was trying to do, man. At no point when I was watching this trailer was like, whoa, I can extract some deep philosophical... themes about how human beings interact with technology from this movie where a guy is like,
you can do both,
smashing a plate over a guy's head. I don't know, man. It's just, it's a fun, I don't have much to say about it, like, other than that, but I still think it's like really fun, and movies like this should be seen, I think, because what passes for fun now, and this is kind of the whatever, the bracket of cinema that I think is kind of being swept away, you know what I mean?
Sure.
Just kind of the lower budget makes its budget back, but doesn't make any waves.
Right.
The theater was completely empty when I went, too.
Oh, well, that's sad.
So...
there were a couple of people, there was about a half dozen of us watching this.
So I think... So. Yeah. So I think, I don't know, the Rotten Tomatoes stuff might be a bit misleading. How many of those critics gave it, you know, 3 out of 5 and said, hey, this is fun, mindless fun.
Well, 3 out of 5 is
like fresh, but that's what I'm saying. They're not, like, it doesn't distinguish its tomato meter by whether you gave it a 5.
No, I think they're, Jesse, you jump in.
I guess the one thing that definitely struck me where, like, I realized, okay, because I thought it was very, very, or at least try to be, like, I thought it came across, at least to me, as like a B movie Kubrick.
Yeah,
And mainly because
it's got a bit of the Matrix in there. It's got a bit of, you know.
I was just getting across because
throw in a little Elysium in there, maybe even a little RoboCop.
Nobody wants Elysium in there.
Fine, the good stuff of Elysium. Anyway, continue.
Anyway, like, well, it's just because of the stem voice. It's just like okay, this is Hal, obviously, from 2001. Like, that's what I was thinking the entire time. Mm-hmm. It's like, except he's a bit more human-sounding as opposed to robot-sounding.
He's not Hal. He's every robot AI in every single sci-fi, which is kind of monotone kind of thing.
Yeah, that's
and I thought, understandable. I thought they played the comedy of him being kind of the straight monotone voice very well. When he's like, you know, makes a comment about a ninja and the voice takes it literally and says, like, I am very sophisticated, but I am not a ninja.
Yeah.
There was some funny aspects that they played off of fact that it was kind of this generic
AI voice. Funnier because there are scenes where he's having, like, full-blown conversations with STEM. And there's a scene where the cop is listening like on a wire that she's placed, and he's having this full conversation, and there's never a reaction shot of her sitting in the police car listening to him having half a conversation.
But there are other scenes where he's talking to himself, right, and then it shows somebody else looking at him, and they do that gag.
Yeah,
it might just, not be the cop.
I wish, like, if they wanted to go for full B movie funny, I think that would have been the way to go. And if they wanted to be like full B movie over the top, there are certainly like over the top moments, like that, how that first fight that from the clip we played ends.
Right.
Like I was shocked at how that ends with a, let's say it ends with a Glasgow smile. It was really quite visceral. And also a really, really striking moment of violence, of over the top violence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think, you said RoboCop.
I said RoboCop.
No, he said RoboCop. Well,
let's
you said
be very
to him.
Clear here.
Good. Well, I don't want to get into who said what, but the point is, RoboCop was mentioned, and right, and the thing about RoboCop is, it is a B movie in the way it walks, and the way it acts, and the way it talks. But
are we talking about the original?
Yeah, we're talking about the original. Okay. But underneath that is the current, and when it goes to like one of the like commercials, or when it goes to, you know, something that's going on in the background, or little details, like the whole thing about the guys in the suits at the corporation too, there's something very serious going on in that, and I think that's the balance that this misses. I think it's reaching for RoboCop. I think it sees RoboCop as a precursor to what it's doing, but it doesn't want to be as balls out as RoboCop was, and it can't quite play things as subtly the way RoboCop does.
Well, it also probably didn't have the budget of RoboCop as well. It might not have been able to play
RoboCop
around with
those.
RoboCop
was a B movie. It was cheap.
Was it though?
Yeah,
I think it made a lot of money when it was.
It made a lot of money, but it the budget was. It wasn't like a $100 million budget or the 1980s equivalent of $100 million budget.
The day when
right. I'm just saying that, but money isn't everything, and I think we all agree this movie looks great.
Yeah.
So you can do a lot on a little.
Yeah, I mean, A Quiet Place had like a very small budget, and looks phenomenal.
Yeah.
But I'm saying there is the slice of that market where it's just, let's not go into the deeper stuff.
Right.
You know what I mean? I think let's just have fun. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not trying to be some science fiction pundit or whatever, making some big, big grandiose statement about
it. I'd love to be a science fiction pundit.
It's a funny, it's a clever gimmick, you know, having STEM kind of control him, and let's run with that.
So basically what you're trying to say is like, look, this isn't like Isaac Asimov or Arthur C. Clarke. This is just simply a movie to have fun with.
Yes, and it does that very well, I think. It's the kind of movie that I think will get more traction on like streaming services. You know what I mean? People will miss it, obviously, in the theater, but then when it comes to the home streaming market or whatever, people will be in the mood for something kind of mindless and entertaining like this.
Well, I mean, I guess just to bring it back to is the simple fact is that Logan Marshall Green, he's been in a few things. I mean, he was in Spider-Man Homecoming like very, very briefly, but he plays a very effective role in the little that he's in. He was also pretty fantastic, I thought anyway, in Prometheus. And of course, like one of his first roles that he was ever in, he played Ryan Atwood's brother in The O.C.
Yeah.
He did.
Yes.
Holy Hannah.
Yeah.
So you did not. Sorry, just to upgrade this conversation.
Okay.
You did not buy any of the emotional stuff that he was doing.
No.
When he was kind of mourning for his wife, whatever.
No.
There's a very interesting scene when he's like kind of crying and he's telling the machine to like administer some kind of medication into him,
right,
and it's implied that he's going to keep administering. I thought that was like a really nice way to kind of, or it was at least different than, you know, him on the couch watching home videos kind of reminiscing about it. That was actually like, okay, he's on the edge here and something needs to like kind of bring him back.
Actually, just to pick up on the point that you're actually making in terms of like over emotional showing of over emotions, is this the type of guy and character that he plays? I mean, he's essentially like, what is he by trade? He's more or less...
He's like a mechanic.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah. Mechanics aren't overly emotional people. I know plenty of them.
Fair points. I think it strikes a wrong chord with me when he's trying to kill himself with the medication. Because I think it just... We could have cut that stuff out and it could have gone right to him being in the hospital the first time. And Aaron comes in and says, "Hey, guy, I got a way that you could be cool." And I had a problem with actually how the whole thing was set up in terms of Aaron comes in, says like, "Okay, I'm going to give you this chip and it's going to be our little secret because the government doesn't like me testing on human subjects for some reason." And but you can't tell anyone, so he has to pretend to be quadriplegic. And there's kind of no thought in either the character Aaron or in the script that, you know, so what's this guy going to do? He's just going to, you know, walk around on his own 2 feet at home and not, you know, I think there is kind of a logical fallacy there, because I think it was very clear once he got like the super chip, he was going to go out and start revenging. And I think that there's an element of irresponsibility on the part of the Aaron character that, you know, you didn't think he was going to, you know, sit in the chair unless he was like alone. But there was also a part of that too where he, like, people clearly know his face and people aren't going to clearly remember a guy in a wheelchair rolling around until he decides to get up when he's alone.
That's too much logic for this movie,
man. I know, but it's stuff that was like sticking in my craw while watching this, and it stopped me from enjoying, I think, the parts of this that were enjoyable. The fights were good. I liked almost all the other actors in this. The guy that played Aaron was like, you know, there's something wrong with him from the start. And I don't know if that's his face or the way he was playing the character, but he was really good.
Villain.
Yeah.
The
guy who invents the
fantastic.
Chip. Yeah. Yeah. I liked the guy that played Cirque. I liked the
I liked the wife.
She was very good. Yeah.
Good too. Yeah.
In a lot of Power Rangers, I noticed in her IMDb.
And what was the one villain? Fisk. I thought he was fantastic.
Yeah,
and he has a very like his face kind of like fit that role, because you're just like, yeah.
He's
I don't
been
trust
in some
that
fights.
Guy.
He's been in some fights. Yeah. He has that face. That fight's taken some punches. That face has taken some punches. And I like the music a lot, and I like the sound design a lot. I thought the music, especially the very classic 80s synth kind of score, it was kind of Blade Runner-esque, but there's a scene where when they implant the chip and he gets out of the chair for the first time, and there's kind of like a Frankenstein vibe to it, where, you know, all that's missing is someone going, "I'm alive," he's alive, right. But I mean, that's the kind of fun this movie could have had if its pure interest was fun. It seems like there's two. Lee Wennell was sort of two minds of what he wanted to do with it, and I'm not sure they exactly coalesce. And if they coalesce for you, I think that's great. But for me, I think there's so much going on in this film that's like sort of prescient and of the moment that it's almost irresponsible to, even in the midst of having fun, to not really take the question seriously, because you know, we are coming precariously close to having machines living in us, and some of us do have machines living in us.
Oh, absolutely. Because this is a debate that politicians even have too about the whole notion of putting chips in ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Anything to add?
Well, I think if you want to educate yourself about all of that, you can watch a documentary. If you want to have fun and see something different and interesting and very entertaining, you should watch this film. Maybe wait till it's, if you're curious, wait till it's, you know, out on some streaming service or whatever. But yeah. I can't argue with the logic flaws or whatever that you're throwing out there, okay? Whatever, yeah. It's like when Looper came out and everyone was like, "Well, what about this?" It's like, okay, but...
Oh, but I'm glad you brought up Looper, because I thought that was an example of what Lee Wendell's going for here. I think that's an example of it.
So
done
you
right.
thought Looper was the...
Yes.
What, intellectually...
Yes.
...big movie?
I'm not sure if it was intellectually big, but I think it did right what I think Upgrade was trying to do and did not quite do right.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, well, I guess you're just talking about differences in terms of personalities and styles.
Yeah, I guess.
And Rian Johnson, like, really just knows how to play with genres.
Right, and part of the one of the things I'll concede with Looper is that it has the voiceover, the voiceover narration of the Joseph Gordon-Levitt character, and that helps when you're trying to explain stuff that's going on in the world, and that's something that this film avoids. And most of the times, I do appreciate that, is just letting you try and figure out what is going on in the world without having someone in your ear, you know, to decode everything. It's, you know, being dropped in a foreign country and something and trying to figure it out for yourself. But I think you are right about this is a movie we need right now. It's not a big blockbuster thing. It's not a small drama thing. It's a very solid, entertaining film. I wish it had been buttoned up more. And I just want to add this one more thing. It's like, it's very interesting that this year we have Lee Wennell doing an Upgrade and his old partner, James Wan, doing Aquaman.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Downgrade.
Well,
who
knows? Like, maybe given that Jason Momoa is playing Aquaman, it might be good.
Right. Oh, we don't have
like okay. The scene. Let me just say this. Okay, all right. The scene, like the classic scene where the detective is on their tail and then they finally catch up to them and there's the interrogation and they ask them all of these questions. I thought the way the movie did it, which was the what is the program called again? The chip.
Oh, STEM.
STEM. Okay. Feeding him the answers that is most likely going to get him out of that situation was a good way to kind of turn that very cliched scene on its head, and I thought it was kind of funny.
Okay, that was a good scene.
Yeah, okay. That's all. That's my piece. Sorry.
All right.
Yeah.
That was a good scene. Okay. All right, fair enough. So, boys, we'll start with Vince. We got him riled up. Where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me on Facebook, Vince Masson, or on Twitter at VMasson5.
All right.
You can find me on Facebook as well, Jesse Malott, and on Twitter as well, at Jesse Malott.
And you can, I'll put in one more plug, because it's the last week you'll be able to see Tim Phillips play at Toronto Fringe, The Joy of Sax. You can buy tickets and find out more information on FringeToronto.com. But it is playing at Theatre Passé Morel at the Main Space several times this week. Or several more times this week, so check it out if you're in Toronto and you get a chance. You can find me on CFRU tomorrow at 5 p.m. for news and politics on open sources, and as with Scotty Hertz there. And in the meantime, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to GuelphPolitico.blogspot.ca, and you can stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we'll be back here next week with, hopefully, a less enraging End credits Wednesday at 2 p.m.
Maybe Jesse will sing this time, too.
Good tease. Anyway, we'll see you then.